I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay, roll call. We're missing Charles. He said he'd be absent tonight. The next on the agenda is citizen input. So if there's any citizens here that would like to address the council on council business, please raise your hand. We'll give you up to 5 minutes to address the council. Okay, do I hear a motion for the, where we have approval of the agenda?
Make that motion.
Mark Snyder? Okay, and Ken Johnson seconded. Any discussions? Okay, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Okay. Any opposed? The same. Okay. Nothing there. This looks different. I gotta get used to this thing. Okay. Consent agenda. I hear a motion on the consent agenda.
I move we accept the consent agenda.
Okay. Second. Okay. Can second. Any discussion? Okay. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The same. All right. That passes. Now we'll go to license agreement with Sun Basin Storage. Daryl.
Thank you, members of the council. For the record, Daryl Piercy, city planner. Before you for consideration is a license agreement with Sun Basin Self Store, owned by Eric Olson. This sign will serve a new business that's located on First Avenue. It will serve Sun Basin Realty, Sun Basin Storage properties, and a future tenant of the site. We have an application to the city for a building permit for the sign. That application has been approved with the condition that the sign be placed outside of the right-of-way. The applicant is proposing to place the sign inside the right-of-way, and as such, additional approvals of the sign would require council action for the license agreement to place that sign within the right-of-way. The right-of-way extends 13 feet beyond the curb, and therefore, as you can see on this photograph, the proposed location of the sign does place the sign within this area, which will be a landscaped area, but it's also inside the right-of-way. We have done analysis of the location of the sign. There are two access points at this site. One is just to the south, and one is in this area to the north. This is actually, the photograph was actually taken as if you were in your car at that northern exit. There's a substantial site distance to the south, which is the direction of this photograph. This is actually the shortest distance in terms of site distance that's provided. The direction to the north actually provides almost 2.5 times the site distance that we have to the south. So that's why I'm showing this particular view. I also have the looking north view available if you'd like to see that. The location down here is the next nearest intersection where the street light is located here, and it's approximately 33 yards, or almost 100 feet, from this location in terms of this site triangle. The speed limit on this roadway is 25 miles an hour at this location. There is a center turn lane, and there are 4 lanes of traffic. But we do believe that the placement of this sign at this location meets all of the minimum standards for site distance and for safety, and it clearly provides an adequate view triangle from that location. Now, this is the most conservative angle for this view. You can pull the vehicle out further onto the sidewalk, and you can have a much more distance in terms of your sight looking down to the south. But we do feel that the site, if the city chooses to issue a license agreement, that the sign location meets minimum site distance standards and will constitute a safe location for the sign.
Questions?
Respond to any questions.
Questions for Daryl?
I'm just not so sure I'm convinced. I mean, we have a 13-foot for a reason. The precedent has been when we put a sign in at our church, the driveways are a lot further away, and we still had to be 13 feet back. I've always been a proponent of line of sight. I mean, yeah, this is the good one. The bad one is when you come out looking north and you got to pull your car out onto the sidewalk to see around the sign.
Actually, this is the bad one. This has a, approximately, well, the site looking north has almost 2.5 times the site distance as this site looking south. I can put that picture up here as well. I tried to get this with some traffic taking place. This van is turning out of the intersection, the nearest intersection to the north, which is the driveway of the medical facility, just to the north of this site. And as you look down here, it's hard to see in this picture as it's enlarged, but there are several cars at this location that are almost 3 blocks away in terms of their distance. Approximately 110 yards, 120 yards at that point in terms of where you can see them. Behind this sign is the car wash a block away, and that car wash is actually at the curb line, or just slightly back from the curb line. If I understand the roadway and the right-of-way section along First Avenue, it looks like the car wash actually sits in the right-of-way. I don't have a history of how that occurred, but it certainly is right at this point along that curb line. And then as we get down farther into Main Street, all of the buildings are to the sidewalk. And so at each intersection, we have a very reduced site distance. And again, it's part of the reason why we have 25 mile an hour speed limit along this roadway, is because it isn't a commercial zone. It's intended to be built with commercial development, some of it coming right to the property boundary, potentially. So that is, I'm sure, the basis for why this was designated 25 mile an hour speed zone, because of this commercial potential and commercial zoning. But in terms of site distance looking north, it's substantially improved versus the picture.
I don't see how you can say that on that far west lane. If you got back 2 feet, right where that telephone pole is, you'd be blocked, and you caught a car coming 25 miles an hour down that lane, and you don't see it and pull out, you're hit.
But that distance, the site distance that you see there, is over 120 yards or 110 yards right in that vicinity. Depending on when you first pick up.
And that's without the front of your car being hanging over on the sidewalk?
No, your front of the car in this picture would be right at the sidewalk line, and the person would be back about this point in the driver's seat. So this is actually taken from the driver's seat of an automobile.
I'm just trying to have you convince me. I don't mean to be snooty, but...
And I understand the concern, and that's why we went through this visual analysis and did double check all of the dimensions and all of the site angles of this site, and why we set up a visual of this nature by placing the sign in the photograph.
Well, worse than that would be a kid riding his bicycle down that.
Yeah, that's true too.
Sidewalk. I mean, there's not much sight distance there for that.
And actually, there's quite a bit. But the problem you have is that most vehicles, you're required to stop twice coming onto the roadway, at the sidewalk and then at the street. So the question is, does everyone follow those rules? Do you stop at the sidewalk, make sure that there's no pedestrians, and then move on to the street and make sure there's no vehicles? Most people stop once and check out the roadway and the pedestrians all at the same time. And again, I'm not here to advocate sign or try to sway your decision. I'm here simply to say that we've done now analysis on the location, and the location meets the safety requirements for a 25 mile per hour speed zone.
How far is the, okay, let's, in relation to the sign up at 14th Avenue Medical Center, sits right out close. How far is that back? Do you happen to know?
At the medical center?
Yeah.
I went out and actually looked at that today. The difference between that sign and this sign is that it's not near an exit of the site. It is near the intersection, but it was placed in a way that did not create any interference at all with the intersection. And it's approximately 4 feet beyond this curb line. But it has absolutely no interference with the entrance and exit of the development, and it had absolutely no impact on the intersection at that location. It met all of the intersection requirements. The actual impact of that intersection is the car wash. That has the most visual impact of any of the signage that's either being proposed or is in place. It actually does a pretty substantial job of blocking the view of the barn.
See, I called that last meeting. I said that would come up.
and the pictures here really don't, it does it good, but it really don't do it full justice until you go down to the site. And I went down to the site and seen it for myself. And there is a lot more room than what actually shows here. I talked to Eric a little bit. Eric gave me an example of what the city of Spokane uses. And what they use, he's actually, his line of sight is four times more than what's required.
And that's true of Othello as well. For that speed zone, it isn't marginal. It's substantially greater than the minimum safety requirements for 25 mile per hour speed zone.
Is it lit at all?
The sign?
Yeah.
It is. And for the purpose of full disclosure, there's also a temperature time display at this location.
So the church moving it back 13 feet maybe could have got an exemption, but the downside is if the city wants to use this easement, the sign comes out.
The license agreement requires that the city have the authority, it allows the city the authority to relocate, to remove the sign in the event that the right-of-way is needed for city purposes.
Is the sign already there?
No.
Just everything else?
We issued a permit, but the permit was very specifically conditioned that the sign must be located outside the right-of-way. The applicant was not happy with that condition, and we explained to him that the only way that it could change is if the council approved a license agreement to place the sign in the right-of-way.
I don't know. I've been on the volunteer fire department for several years, and just driving emergency equipment and seeing the goofy things people do, I'm always reluctant to grant these variances. And I pushed for years to cut fences on corners and put buildings back and get the bushes down on corners. And it goes against everything that I've tried to process.
Ken?
Well, first of all, let's go back a few years. You mentioned First Street, for instance, but we've got some buildings that set right along the sidewalk. I don't know whether any of you recall this or not, but back several years ago, they actually cut 2 feet off of some of those buildings and set them back. So therefore, you had a wider sidewalk, which made an 8-foot sidewalk, which was still bigger, according to our 10-foot sidewalks we had up Main Street. Well, as that happened, people went ahead and built on that 8-foot sidewalk. And yes, you do have somewhat of a problem. This particular one is only a 5-foot sidewalk. And I kind of agree with you. I mean, this is just sitting right out there on the edge of it. I went down there and drove into that parking lot. Of course, the sign wasn't there. But if you park there where you can actually supposed to be before you come out on the street, I don't know. I question that line of sight because, if you've got a little car, maybe you can see around that. But you take what used to be a regular sized car and you set back there, and you can't see that telephone pole. Well, I don't think, and I don't think you can see down at probably even the other intersection. I mean, my way of thinking, the way I was looking at it the other day, it's pretty tight. I mean, if you want to put a rider on there and put a liability clause in that, then it might be a different situation here.
But Mr.
The agreement, we do require that they provide insurance, meaning the city as additional insured. Mr. Whitaker can speak to that.
It's already provided on page 3. Excuse me, page 2. It's on page 2, it's item 5, that they will provide insurance and they will indemnify the city for their use.
It's a tough one. This company, this entity is just an excellent supporter of the community, and I hate to beat them back. But
you know, they make great studies. The new building looks wonderful.
Yeah.
The sign looks wonderful. It's nothing, cheap or quickly put up. And like I said, until you actually go down there and look at it and pull up to the driveways yourself, then I believe there is a lot of sight, visual sight. I'm going to go ahead and move to approve the license agreement to Sun Basin Properties.
I assume that can't be moved back any.
Not without narrowing the side. It's at its maximum point back.
Have they considered elevating it?
We have not spoken with them in regards to that. Again, we reviewed the permit, so the sign needed to be out of the right way, but we didn't talk any specifics regarding this proposal or proposing modifications. I think they're pretty excited about the sign design.
I hear a motion. Do we have a second? Okay, motion is denied then. So I guess we'll move to the next one. Okay, ball field lighting. Larry.
Thank you. If I may, there was a lady here that wasn't sure that she actually had something she wanted to say during the citizens' input, but was a little bit confused with the agenda. So if I may point out, she had asked to say something. Is that okay?
Is that okay with council? Yes. Litka, you get up to 5 minutes, okay?
Yeah,
okay. I need to have your name and your address.
Litka Sikora, and my address is 13743 Chelsea Highway, Leavens Boris, 98826. I came here to protest my payment for the basic water and sewer and all, you know, garbage, because when I come here, I'm using only water for irrigation. When I come here to irrigate my yard, otherwise I have to take care of same amount of burden in Levensworth, where I am now living. And I was explained by the clerk in today that is because we have expended for maintenance of the pipes. I don't think I should participate in maintenance or services when I am not here. I think that I already took my participation on it for 40 years. When I was here and I was using it. So I wanted to know if can be done something that we have either one lowering that kind of fee, but not paying over $60 a month for everything what we don't use. Who are having a house for sale here, and now the stock market is just stopping, you know. So it could take months and months what we will be paying those money for nothing. And we need the money another place. And definitely I am on fixed income. It's a big burden for me to pay in two places everything twice. So if council can consider something, maybe some different way, how we can pay the water, but not the rest of it.
Anybody have a comment?
And I think it's more people here than only I do who has a house on the market, and they are not anymore here.
Daddy? Question. I know we have a minimum set on the water and the sewer, and I could understand the minimum because that is for every resident of the city of Montgomery. Even though we don't use our full water permit, but for garbage, could a customer or have somebody have their garbage can picked up? We just don't have that service, but not be billed for it, or is a citizen still billed for garbage?
Even when the water is turned on to a meter, and sewer and garbage, if the sewer is available and if it's inside the city limits, we charge minimum. So for a minimum is a 65-gallon toter, and I think that's about $13 a month, 13-something. So that way there is garbage along with every water account. There is sewer and garbage, and that keeps, you know, everybody using some kind of garbage service. And we have reduced turds down to the 65-gallon toter.
Oh.
Because I don't have hearing, moving hearing.
Oh, okay.
So, whatever. People decided. Hope you will find some way.
Yeah, Lipka, we can't make an adjustment just for you. We'd have to change how we're doing it, I guess, the best way to put it. Because it has to be for everybody. It can't be just for one person in the city.
It's not one person. It's, like I said, it's, I think about 7 houses for sale here. And people are not here anymore. And like I said, we participate already in the new place and all those services and maintenance and whatever it's for us. And I was here 40 years. I think I give enough money for everything in 40 years. So.
Yeah, we really can't do anything for you that way because it has to be for all the citizens. So, you know, as much as we'd like to be able to, but.
If I do on the council, the water, then of course, you know, there will be, the property will be completely damaged.
If you turn the water off?
This will be turned off water. So, I don't know what is the solution for me to have money for what I need money help for. And that is the most important, medical and food on the table. And insurances we have to pay.
Well, thank you for coming, but like I said, there's nothing we can really do as far as changing unless the council would like to approach that in the future, but.
I may talk with Mr. Johnson, when I talk with you directly, I understand what we are communicating. Yeah, so I will stop in your place. Thank you
for coming.
I will. Thank you.
Okay, ball field lighting, Larry.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor and Council. Purchase lighting from Musco Lighting Equipment for the northwest and southeast ball fields at Lions Park. And with respect to where this area is, north being straight up on the page, 7th Avenue is off to the left, and Pine Street is down south. The new sidewalk that's going in as part of the Lions Park, 2010th Street, and infrastructure improvements would be up here on Hamlet, and where the parking lot extension in front of the swimming pool would be further to the east on Pine. This is actually the second phase of a lighting program the city started a few years ago and had Musco as the company to purchase the lights from. This is the second phase where the city has budgeted funds for both the northwest and southeast ball fields. This is a purchase only agreement. The next step is to put out a small works roster contractor to actually install the lighting. But everything was basically set up in the first phase of lights for the northeast and southwest ball fields were installed. So the contractor will come in, install some new periphery lights along the exterior of the fields. If you'll recall, there's some wooden poles there now. Those wooden poles will come out, and the steel poles that are around the northeast and southwest, new poles would put it similar to that. And then on some of the existing interior steel lights that are between the ball fields, there'll be a second set of lights put on each of those poles, because right now there's lights on one side of them, but not on the other side. So we'll be able to do double duty on these interior poles, which are these black dots here, by having lights on both sides. The city had budgeted funds for both the purchase and the installation, and this is the purchase portion of it. And the amount with sales tax to Musco is $108,238.50. It'll take approximately a month once the purchase order has been approved and signed, submittals approved for them to get the lights on site, and then we'll be working with Public Works to put together the small works roster contract to have a contractor come in and install them.
Yeah, go ahead, Ken.
I guess I have a question. I don't know exactly where we're at here. We're talking about $108,000 here on that contract. And I think when we were looking at those figures as far as budget, we've got a $90,000, $75,000, and then there's a $10,000 for the tennis court and the basketball court.
Right.
And I even had Mike dig in that a little bit. I think there's some other lighting besides that. How does that figure into those figures? In other words, we're talking this 108. Is that a portion of that 90 and the 65 or whatever it is, 1,000? Does that go into those two?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
It actually tracks right on with where the original dollar amounts were anticipated when the budget was put together. I think at the time, back in January, when we first started talking to staff about this, we were about $105,000, but with sales tax, it comes up to $108,000. So we're right in the ballpark of what had originally been anticipated. Because the city had worked with Musco before and has a good relationship with them, they're a premier outfit for ballpark lighting, and I think we've got a pretty good deal there. Realizing it is a lot of money, it's fits right in with the amount that had been budgeted.
This Musco lighting includes none of the hardware for the basketball court?
No, it does not. That was an additional $10,000 that had been budgeted. We feel that it's more decorative lighting than the real tall poles are, and we'd probably get a better bang for our buck if we had the contractor who's going to install the lights install the decorative pole at the ball field or the basketball court, rather than have Musco come in with overkill, if you will.
We don't want a decorative pole at the basketball. We take that game seriously, and we want official poles. but seriously, and no mistake, this doesn't include the tennis courts, which lighting there is marginal at best. And I'm not sure. Do you have specs? Would it include? I mean, we have two basketball courts now. Does that include both of them? Was our intent, or is one lit now? Or does anybody remember? I don't. I think they play one at night.
We've been told that it was for the basketball court, but there's $10,000 budgeted for it. And I don't think, since electrical service is there already, you could probably get both tennis courts and the basketball court for that amount.
Okay.
I have a question on the poles. So there's no chance these things will be blown down. It seems like our wind is getting worse and worse. It just seems that way.
They come with a pretty stout concrete base.
Do they?
It goes into the ground. I don't know if it has the depth in here now, but it's sized for seismic and wind loads to meet the current IBC or building codes.
Mm-hmm. Up to 85 miles per hour.
Then on top of that, I think we've got some light.
When I read that.
Goes into Kiwanis Park.
Right.
I think at one time we were trying to get all those in one contract as much as we could to keep that price down.
We plan on doing that. We've met both with Stan and Terry with our electrical engineer last week to make sure that we have sufficient electrical service to both sites. Things look real good. The installation at Lions Park here will be quite simplified because of the work that had been done previously. And the work at Kiwanis will be to add a few more lights and the security cameras that Stan has already purchased. So the city had actually budgeted $65,000 for that total cost.
For just Kiwanis?
For Kiwanis.
Which would be in addition to these three items?
Yeah. So literally, if you want to take both ball fields, basketball lighting, and the Kiwanis lighting together, that's $240,000. Mm-hmm. At least this is $108,000.
Have you got that printout that we were working on? I didn't get it on the computer, sorry. We kind of highlighted those particular items for the lighting portion there. And I want to just be sure that we're staying in that same picture here, basically.
Any more questions?
Well, is there, I mean, this is, as you state, only one piece of the puzzle. It appears we're going to, the next piece is the installation and the actual lighting for Kiwanis and the basketball court that will be in the within the budget.
We anticipate coming back in probably about a month to have the small works roster packet together and then go out small works roster for a contractor to install. And the time was wanting to do it after summer so that we wouldn't interfere and have as much of the park disrupted as, mm-hmm. the least amount as possible for both parties.
So who would you see bidding on installation? Would it be more of an electrical company, or is it somebody that installs the lights that contracts out electrical?
With the bidding climate we have now, it's probably going to be a little bit of everybody.
Okay.
I wouldn't be surprised if the electrical subcontractor that's on the traffic signals for Main Street put in a bid. MRM has equipment that could at least get the light poles up and have their electrical do the electrical work. State law requires that when a licensed electrical engineer do the actual electrical work, and they'll have to get a permit from State Department of Labor and Industry for that. But I think we'll see a lot of contractors from all sorts of avenues or types of work coming.
Well, you can see my concern. I don't want $108,000 worth of light sitting on the pallet and then the contract to install them comes in at $200,000 or something ridiculous.
Yeah. We're still seeing such competitiveness in the market that Mark, I think we'll get a very competitive bid here as well.
Sean, you had a comment?
I have a question. On the southeast field, the lights that are set up on the outfield fence line right there, are those lights, is it possible for those two poles, for the lighting at those two locations to be pointed in the opposite direction so that they flood the field between the softball field and the basketball courts and tennis courts on the other end of the park? And the reason I ask is because of 4th of July coming up in August, we have American Fiesta Amistad. Any other events that are nighttime events, would we have the ability to illuminate the field so that people can see clearly to make their way after the sun falls?
Interesting.
After the sun sets, excuse me.
Sean, that sounds really good. But I think we have some trees in there that might cause a problem or a lot of shading problem, too. We've got the great big oak tree, and we've got some pine trees in there.
Well, we have a sycamore tree for shade. We have the pine trees there. I guess another question is how tall are those poles?
Yeah.
If they are taller than the trees, something is better than nothing.
Yeah.
And the visibility at night is the issue that I'm asking about. And we all get at the park in the evenings there.
Mm-hmm.
we, for the Fiesta, we turn on the tennis court lights, and it was just mentioned a moment ago that the lighting there is marginal. But it does help, just to give you a sense of your bearings, and so the folks aren't stumbling over one another as they're going through, especially after the sun goes down. So I'm asking, it's one of those Swiss Army knife kind of questions. Does it have the ability to do more than one thing?
We can definitely look into that. The poles themselves will be between 60 and 70 feet tall. We can see illumination-wise if, I think there's either 9 or 10 lights per pole, per side. So we can look and see if taking one and turning the light the other direction, what that does candle watt power-wise. I'll be honest to say that I'm not a ballpark lighting expert, but I know they have to have a certain amount of light per baseball codes. We can definitely look into it.
Is that something the council would like them to do?
So we could look at just using those poles and putting the same lights as we're going to put on now on that back side, just like we do in the middle here.
Another possibility would be less powerful lights, not at the complete height of the pole. Maybe something less illumination. These are pretty bright lights. Something halfway up the pole pointed towards the east that could be wired in at the same time.
I mean, ideally, if it, with that kind of setup, you'd have a separate switch for those lights because, you know, you've got three events going on in the year where you'd need those lights.
Be a lot less money to do it when they're putting those poles up,
yeah,
if we want to do it.
And if you want to light up the whole ball field to light over where the festival is, that you're going through some BTUs there.
So it sounds like we're favorable to looking into this?
I think what you're looking at right now is to go ahead and purchase these lights, right? Mm-hmm. So we could go ahead and do that, and then we could have that as an add-on. Can we do that before they're actually installed?
Before they're even manufactured, we'll look into that.
Okay. We want to delay this action of getting them on site or whatever, so we can get the rest of it. I know how long it takes once you send in the order, you may be 6 months down the road getting the lights here. I don't know how that is this day and age.
They've told us it would be about 30 days. Surprised me, but that's what they said in their quotes. That's after a purchase order has been approved and there's shop drawings that have to be reviewed. So that probably takes a week and a half, say 2 weeks on the outside there. So we may be looking at a month and a half before they'd actually be on site, which would give us considerable amount, plenty of time to look into any alternate lights and report back to council.
Yeah, they should be the experts on that. It shouldn't be really anything new to them. That.
So do I hear a motion to authorize the mayor to enter into a contract as sole source provider with Muscat Lighting as quoted? Okay, Gina?
Second.
Mark Snyder, second. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the same? Okay, that passes. And I guess you'll look into
what
we can do as far as probably going to need to get it above the trees if we're going to try to do what Sean's mentioning there. If the poles are above the trees, I assume they are. So, but, okay, thank you.
Thank
you. Sean, do you have something else?
Yeah, one other thing. On that northeast field, the light that's there, trees are not an obstruction over on that end of the park. So the northeast ball field lights could be pointed south toward Pine Street and give us some crowd cover and be helpful. So the southeast and the northeast fields are the two fields that would be worth looking at for that question.
Okay, thank you. Resolution regarding liquor profits and excise tax, Ken?
Well, as we talked in our workshop, we kind of look at this same kind of consensus of the council here that these two initiatives that are coming up, basically 1100 and 1105, basically directly affect city budget. And I think that the city should take one step ahead here and say, hey, this thing is somewhat of our problem. If these initiatives happen to go through and they go to vote and they're, say, approved, it's going to change this whole concept of where your tax dollars come from. There's two different phases of this. There's a phase which is the liquor profits portion of it, which goes into one fund, and I think our fund was, I didn't have it figured out. I've cut this resolution, but I want to give you some background on this resolution and what I'm trying to do here. But it amounts to almost $55,000 for the city of Othello. This is this portion, which is for different programs related to programs the police department puts on and training and whatnot for young people and different projects that goes on. Then there's the other phase of it, which is the excise tax of this money, which is actually a tax put on the liquor sales, and that portion goes directly to the police department as well, which helps man your officer or funds your officers and things like that. And I think this last one was around $32,000 in that fund. So this thing is directly affecting us. If it goes to a privatized system, that particular profit portion of it will go away completely. And the excise portion will go down. So the $55,000 will just totally disappear. The $33,000, $32,000 will probably drop because the price of liquor will go down, so therefore your taxes go down. So the city gets hit in two stages of that. A lot of people don't realize that. They say, hey, this is a great deal. I can go buy me a bottle of booze. It's going to cost me less money. But they don't know the backside of this thing, what effect it is. Just give you a quick example. On the profits themselves, the state gets 50% of that. That goes straight to the general budget. The cities get 40%. And the county gets 10%. Right now, on the excise tax, the state gets 65%. The cities get 28%. And the counties get 7%. So it directly affects you, not only in the city, but in the counties. And what this resolution does that we've got here right now, it doesn't necessarily, I can't say it really does too much other than say that us as a city, that we need to look at this as a voter, and that us as a city, we're not for this changing of this and privatizing it. And besides the jobs that are going to be lost, and whatnot. So that's basically what that resolution is all about. I just want to give you some background on it. I think you can read the resolution and pretty well decide for yourself what it's trying to do. We didn't put all the particular things in it. We left it kind of open-ended there. It's not really putting us out as far as anything. It just gives us the open idea that, hey, this is how it affects a city of the size of Othello. I mean, that's basically what it amounts to.
I guess...
totally confusing?
No. I guess my opinion is I believe in smaller government, so I'm for privatizing myself personally. And I think, I mean, you look at cigarettes, if you want more taxes, they just throw them on. They'll do that to alcohol too. You know, if it goes down, I see the state legislation just basically raising the taxes on it because they can call it, what do they call those things? There's a name for it, but where they're hitting those things that cause sickness, you know, the things with the health deal and all that stuff. And but I guess I always feel like private business generally does a better job than government. So I'm not particularly for this myself.
Well, where this will also hurt too is a lot of the liquor stores that are currently open are still privately run, even though the liquor is controlled through the state. For example, our store down here is privately owned but with a contract with the state. And what this will do is actually eliminate all those small businesses that have those particular stores and the people that run them. Basically, it'll put them out of business if they're able to start selling hard liquor in all of our grocery stores. So that's another effect of it too, is the thousands that could actually impact that way too.
What will also happen is, I understand the privatizing things, but people like Costco, people like Walmart, they're going to get that profit. And that booze price is going to remain almost the same. It may go down a little bit, but all that profit money, you're not going to benefit one dime from it. It's going to be gone, it's going to be out of state. So, I mean, they're not going to increase any other people as far as employment. I mean, they'll just run it like they do now. That's
what it'll offer. It'd be a lot easier for people to shoplift it to a big store like that instead of, you know, a store where they got it behind the counter and stuff like that.
So did I hear a motion?
I move adoption of the resolution expressing the council's opposition to the initiative 1111.05.
Second, Gina. Any more discussion?
I would like to see this resolution also backed up with a letter to the Association of Washington Cities supporting that they don't adopt this too.
Yeah, because the comment was that they're not.
They haven't taken a stance yet.
Yeah, that's still. They haven't taken it yet, but I think saying we're going to go out here and do it first, but if we can send this to other cities and then put some pressure on AWC, and then they can help lobby this thing and get some advertising in here. Because people don't know what's going on. I mean, they have no idea. And that's why I think that we need to step out there and do something.
Okay. We can do that also. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed, the same. Okay, it passes then. All right. All right, ordinance to amend OMC 4.24 entitled Garage Sales. Debbie?
Upon review of the OMC regarding the garage sales, we found several issues to discuss with the council, and we did review these at the workshop. The current ordinance provides that garage sales should only be conducted on residential premises, and we've been issuing garage sale permits for nonprofit organizations to be conducted in Pioneer Park and in other areas, such as in the commercial areas of the churches. Staff was advised to discontinue issuing the garage sale permits for nonprofit organizations to be held in Pioneer Park and also for the permits in the commercial areas. Based upon the discussion of the workshop, we have made the following changes to the ordinance, which is actually in Chapter 4.24, the Naoka Municipal Code, and we've added that nonprofit organizations and civic organizations may have yard sales on their privately owned property or in Pioneer Park, as long as they meet all of the requirements in this chapter. Staff recommends that council approve the ordinance amending Othello Municipal Code Chapter 4.24 entitled Garage Sales.
Questions for Debbie?
I talked to you a little bit about it today, Debbie. under this new ordinance that would come up, basically it would be eliminating any garage sales on commercial property.
Unless there's a residential unit on the property.
Okay, so this one eliminate, like the one being in June that the funeral home puts on Stevens?
No, because their residential unit is on that property.
But that does not affect sidewalk sales, things like that, that businesses can do.
Well, because they're selling their product,
mm-hmm.
and it's not, a garage sale is supposed to be sale of normal household items, used items.
Okay.
I did just have one scenario that I may bring up, and it's happened a couple times when, for example, all my brothers and sisters have got together, got all of their materials. A lot of them don't have, living within the city limits. So they want a place to have a yard sale that's more convenient here in town. And they went down to our business, and on a day that we're closed, Saturday, it has had a garage sale down there. That would also eliminate other that from happening completely. Not just my example, but if anybody else wanted to do that. I don't mind you having a garage sale on a commercial property, but maybe limiting it to once a year, because then the business itself is not using that as raising funds all the time.
Go ahead, Ken.
To go along with that same item, we've got an issue coming up this next Saturday, I think, August the 14th. I think you've got a memo about that. And they want to have a garage sale, and it's on commercial property that's already been advertised for that sale. And if we would adopt something like this, I think we would have to have a consensus of it. Of the council here to at least okay that particular sale. So I don't know how it'll affect the ordinance, but at least this particular one has to be close on that issue, whether it would be go into effect or what would happen, because that would be on commercial property.
Yeah, Debbie's already called four council members.
Yeah, I tried to get a hold of all the council members on Friday, and I did get a hold of four council members that advised me to let Donna McCann know that they would approve it this one time only, that she would have to look at a different location or a different program for next year, and she was okay with that.
I think your verbiage of it in Pioneer Park, you might come back to us eventually and want to restrict that a little bit, because that kind of leaves it wide open. And what they normally do is have it off to the side, and that's all good, but it doesn't say they have to do that. And if they start, you know, encroaching on the farmer's market and that, it could get ugly. Yeah.
I think that'd be good. Or in the west side of Pioneer Park.
Mr. Mayor, perhaps it would be appropriate to say, to answer Mr. Spohr's question, concern, or in Pioneer Park in designated areas.
Thank you.
Yep. That way you're not guessing
right.
Where things are and where they might move in the future.
Okay, thanks, Jim.
Yeah, that would cover it.
I would approach it.
Okay, then Ken Johnson brought up something. I mean, I guess my view is you can always find a place to go as far as a family. I mean, you have a place,
well, yeah.
You know, as far as that goes. Yeah, and you don't get in conflict with the commercial, because if we start that, how do we stop it? That's going to be the conflict.
You can always find a friend or somebody. As long as it's residential, you can always find somebody that would probably let you have your garage sale in town.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I guess we'll have to bring back the ordinance again, because we made a change, right, Jim?
The council could approve the ordinance by adding in primary parking designated areas, if they wished, tonight, as it's proposed for amendment and be effective 5 days after public meeting.
Okay, so do I hear a motion to adopt an ordinance amending Othello Municipal Code Chapter 4.24 entitled Garage Sales and for Pioneer, how'd you say it, Pioneer Park in designated areas only?
Right, I'm amending the new subsection F of Code 30.
Okay, do I hear a motion?
So moved.
Okay, Dan, first?
Second.
Ken Kaler, seconded. Any more discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the same? Okay, that passes, thank you. Okay, ordinance to amend OMC 12.16.330 entitled Enforcement of Liens.
With the passing of the new state law, which is ESB 6261, we found that we needed to make some minor changes to our Othello Municipal Code relevant to termination of utilities to rental residential units. Our current code provides for a 3-day notice prior to termination. With the adoption of the new state law, we are now required to provide written notice to residential rental units at least 7 days prior to shutting off the water utility for non-payment. Our current code also provides a process for renters to establish a sub-account if their landlord has become delinquent in order to keep the utilities on. Our current code requires that a deposit would be made by that tenant in the amount of 2 times the highest month of utility service charges within the past 12 months. The new law provides that if a landlord fails to pay for water services, any tenant may request that the services be placed in their name and may deduct that amount from the rent. According to the amendment to the RCW, we need to provide water services to a tenant on the same terms and conditions as other residential utility customers. So we can no longer require a deposit because we don't require a deposit for other customers. And just for your information, we do encourage our landlords to keep the utility accounts in their names. If they want a renter to be responsible, that renter has to come in with proper photo ID to set up the account, and the landlord has to sign up a waiver acknowledging that they are ultimately responsible for the utility. The ordinance contains the changes, the proposed ordinance contains the changes regarding the 7-day notice, and we've taken out the requirement about the deposit for tenant subaccounts. We have the choice to perform a 3-day shutoff notice for other customers and a 7-day shutoff notice for the tenant accounts, but that would take just too much staff time to work with 2 different notice lists and 2 different shutoffs. So we would suggest that we provide a new 7-day shutoff notice for all customers. Staff's recommendation is to approve the ordinance amending Othello Municipal Code Section 12.16.330 entitled Water and Sewer Service and Rights.
Any questions for Debbie? Okay, so do I hear a motion to adopt an ordinance amending Othello Municipal Code Section 12.16.330 of Chapter 12.16 entitled Water and Sewer Service and Rates. Gina?
Second.
Ken Johnson was second. Any more discussion?
As I'm understanding, a renter can get on the water utilities, city utilities, without a deposit.
Without a deposit. Well, yes. Yes. We used to have a deposit, but the council changed the ordinance several years ago. We don't require a deposit.
Because a renter has a lot less at stake than a landlord.
Yes.
We live in an endless circle. What has happened is we have a policy we developed at the city in an effort to try to protect the utility as much as we could, because it's been 20, 25 years now, probably since Blue versus Seattle and then the Pro Dallas case, and a series of landlord-tenant cases in the Ninth Circuit, that you can't let landlords use turning off power or water as a means for a cheap eviction. You have to give tenants the right to remain in their place and duke it out in court over whether or not they should or should not be evicted. So that's what the Ninth Circuit thinks about. Well, somebody in the legislature helped us out with this new law that Debbie called me about.
and Debbie drafted this very fine amendment here. And it works very well. But it points out that the bottom line is, in this state, unless you require every utility customer at their household to post a deposit, and the city of Salt Lake does that, has a small deposit for the first year, and then if your account is current, the deposit's returned, and you're in good standing. And if it, you haven't kept your account current, then you got to keep the deposit for another year. And I mean, that works because they don't have a lot of accounts. I'm sure here, where you have a lot more accounts, that would be a real task to keep track of all that kind of thing. But the bottom line of this law is, if you let yourself come in as the homeowner and get an account open without a deposit, under this law, in this circumstance, you have to let the tenant come in and do the same thing.
Apparently electrical and telephone companies don't operate under the same.
Oh, electric, the state statute covers both electrical and water purveyors. So the city of Ellensburg is having to have this policy apply to both its water utility and its electric utility.
But if an account goes unpaid and we've gone through this process, we are able to shut off the water service, and that is our lien upon the property for the water, and then we can file a lien for sewer and garbage. No, it's owed for sewer and garbage.
Even if the tenant has taken over the account and just walks away from a $200 water bill?
Yes. We have 120 days. Because the form Debbie described that we make the owner sign says, don't send me the bill, send it to the tenant, but I understand I'm still responsible. And basically, this state law preserves that relationship so long as the tenant follows the process under the statute, that the ultimate person responsible is the landlord. That's why I believe Debbie's department suggests, we of course can't tell people what to do, but suggest to landlords that it's probably in their best interest to keep those accounts in their name so they know what goes on their accounts.
Isn't the landlord refusing to sign a cheap way to evict?
Well, no. Well, when they open up the tenancy with the tenant, they have to have water where people can't live there. So if they keep the account in their name, it just goes on.
Right.
And they would have to evict by using the 5918 process. If they have signed it over to the tenant and then come in and tell us they want it cut off, that's also would lead to the same kind of notice to the tenant, because they're going to stop, there's going to be a stopping in payment. So, I mean, it can get a little more technical than the state law provides, but I think, at least here, I have no concern that Debbie's people will handle this very well, because we've been through a number of different situations over the years and have always worked out how to handle them, because despite the state legislation, we also still have to comply with the Ninth Circuit rule that tenant has some rights to be there until property is vacant. So.
And I think our staff does an excellent job at collecting and tracking accounts. And seriously, we probably have a dozen or so accounts that are shut off or non-payment. Not that many for a big town in our community. So she does a really, really good job. If people want water, they follow the rules.
Okay, so I hear a motion to adopt an ordinance amending Othello Municipal Code section. Did I already say that?
Yeah.
We already had a first and second, didn't we? Yeah. That's right. Dan, you first? Who first?
Johnson.
Okay, that's who it was. Okay. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, the same? Okay, that passes.
Thank you,
Debbie. Okay. So everybody clicks to the next page. where is it? There it is. Okay, ordinance creating OMC chapter 8.64 entitled Parental Responsibility. Jim?
Yes, the council had requested that I revise the previous draft, and I did that. I also dug a little deeper into how extensively the state has taken over preemption of this area. As is noted in the section 010, RCW 9-101-010 was adopted 2 years ago. That was essentially in response to the Yakima Valley ordinances, particularly the Toppenish ordinance, in which the state has preempted the area of providing technical definitions of criminal street gangs, criminal street gang members, street gang offenses, those sorts of things. The statute also indicates that those definitions are to be used in connection with state sentencing and criminal code violations. At the same time, the state amended RCW Chapter 994A, which is a sentencing statute, and provided a series of definitions which are adopted by reference in this ordinance. It also provides in there that violations of certain state laws, when the activity is deemed related to criminal street gangs, relates in enhanced or different penalties, which indicates that the state has preempted the area of differing penalties for criminal or street gang activity, probably conclusively, which would indicate why the police chief previously told you, I believe related to the council previously a couple of meetings ago, that when he contacted Yakima Valley cities, what they were doing about ordinances like this, they were simply not enforcing them because they had been told by their city attorneys not to. And I suspect that was because of the preemption by the state law. But what is proposed to you complies with the state law, brings back RCW 424-190, which is the state law that makes parents responsible for up to $5,000 for the damages their minor children do. Basically, the theory behind this is that if children commit crimes here, and it's not just really, it is aimed at criminal street activity, but it is not limited as some of the other things were to just tagging or gathering together to make a nuisance in a location. This is to anything they do. The theory behind this is that your police department has to incur expenses and costs to go out and find them, arrest them, detect them. Then you contribute money to the district court system that's going to prosecute them, and they may very well be incarcerated after their conviction by the county, which all of you pay for as county taxpayers. So the purpose of this is to recover from the parents the costs that are imposed upon the community by the criminal activities of their children. It also provides that as a reminder to the parents that if their children are causing damages in the community, they might very well also receive an infraction for not keeping track of their children and letting them engage in these things. And it starts at $100, then we go to $250, and then we go to $500. So that it's not that it's a big penalty at first, it's a penalty that doesn't have to be imposed. I mean, if a parent has a reason why they went, you know, they were supposed to be camping with their church group or whatever, but they ran off and did this other thing, I mean, I can see where we wouldn't be issuing an infraction to parents for that sort of thing. But it provides a means to follow the state law, the state, or for the city to become one of those injured persons who would want to make demand for recovery of the impact to the community for the costs of taking care of prosecuting their children for their crimes. So that is presented for your consideration.
Questions? Comments?
Thank you for your help earlier to Jim.
Oh, did that work out?
And that worked out really good. And there was a lot of misconception on the $5,000 fine. A lot of people thought it was a $5,000 fine being imposed on. But it's actually not. Like I said, it's just a means for the city to help get reimbursement for the time that we spend on these gang-related juvenile crimes. And I think it's a start. It's not as big a bite as I would like to see, but we've got to start somewhere. And this is something I think that would be really good. And I have no doubt that if it was challenged, it would hold up very well.
Yeah, I think also with the $100 penalty the first time the parent become more engaged, all of a sudden, at least I would, but I know that myself, so I think that'll really help. I like what I've been reading here. So. So I hear a motion to pass this parental responsibility ordinance numbered 8.64.010 and 020.
I'll make that motion.
OK. Okay, Ken Johnson first.
Second.
Mark Snyder second. Any more discussion? Okay, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, the same? Okay, that passes. Great, thank you. Okay, ordinance to amend the 2010 budget. Mike?
Good evening, Mr. Mayor and Chairman of Council. I'm Mike Bailey, Finance Officer. I have before you a budget, an amendment to the 2010 budget, and it's 99.9% Main Street associated. And I think it's pretty self-explanatory. To fund the Main Street project, we took money from other funds. And what I'm doing is, we created a project fund for Main Street. And so what I'm doing is moving all the money from these other funds into that project for funding. And so that we can keep track of the Main Street project, everything in one place. That makes it much easier, and it makes it more easier to be accountable for what's going on with the project. There is one little nuance, and I just want to show it to you on this overhead. This utility tax right here for $644,107. The Main Street project gets $592,507 of that, and the other amount, which I'll show you right here, that's down at the bottom. The other amount is $51,402. And that's debt service, an interest payment on the debt service for the Main Street bond issue. So I added it to the amount for the budget amendment for that fund. I knew I'd have to come back to you before the end of the year and make that payment. So I just threw in that payment as well. And in my math, I didn't change this upper number, and so I'll take care of all of that when we finalize this ordinance. So I just wanted to make sure you understood that, so I didn't think I was pulling the whole other horizon. So the budget amendment is for the funds up in the upper portion of the agenda memo, and then down below it shows other funds that we are using. And because those funds are already budgeted, we can simply transfer the money from those funds to the Main Street project. And that's the sum total of the budget. Are there any questions?
Questions? Okay, so do I hear a motion to adopt the ordinance to amend the 2010 budget as presented with Mike's adjustments? Okay, Gina first.
I'll second.
Okay, Taylor second. Any more discussion? Okay, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the same? Okay, it passes. Thank you, Mike.
Thank you.
Okay, unfinished business. Go ahead, Mark.
This is related to last week's workshop that I wasn't here. And I like all you guys, but I can't figure you out. We put in a $60,000 conduit on Main Street as a prerequisite to a $500,000 project to put trees in and lights and improve it aesthetically. And then a guy comes to my neighborhood and builds a garage as big as a shop and ruins the total aesthetics of my neighborhood. And then it says, we don't need to change them just because some people don't like how something looks. And that's what I said about Main Street. Anywho, if anybody wants to reconsider, I think garages and their size ought to have limits. And I am more than willing to work with somebody in reapproaching that. Because I think what got put up in that neighborhood is ridiculous and there ought to be some limits.
I fall into line with that. I was going to bring that up and have my say. We say how big a garage has to be in a attached garage to a house. It has to be 20 by 20, and it has two cars, and it has to have a 16-foot door on it, or whatever it is. But we have no restrictions on it on a detached garage. If you've got enough lot, you can build a 150-foot garage, 60 feet wide, across your property. If I was the guy up there that owned the house next door, I'd be really mad. And when I go to sell that property, that's going to be a detriment to the sale of my property. I mean, that thing sits out there, and granted, it's a nice building, it's well built, it's well covered, it's painted, it's everything. It's a nice building, but it doesn't fit with the neighborhood. And there's got to be some way to get around that. I think we need to approach that in some way to protect the rest of the people. And there are several places around town that those have been built. You know, there's up here, John Pierre had one up there. He put up a two-story thing, and there's one, I think, across the street, down about a half a block, another one. And if you put it up there where 10 of the 12 houses in the area are two-and-a-half-story houses that are 35 feet high, then it's not a problem. But in an area where you have single-story buildings, and if nothing else, go back to the 18-foot height requirement that gives you 13-foot door and 5 feet for a house for the roof. And I don't see any reason what's wrong with that. I don't know about the square footage thing that he was talking about, and that I didn't. But there's a lot of houses in town that aren't near as big as that garage. You know, all these up in here that United Builders built up between 11th and 14th on Hemlock, Larch, Spruce, you know, they're what, 800-foot houses. So I think we need to approach that another way. So we need to
kind of going along
look at that
same,
again.
Same lines, you know, there was a clause in there, 850 square feet. And I don't know how you can get 850 square feet in a, I mean, you can get, like say 100 by 120 building, I think that's a little more than 850 square feet. But I think there's a fine line there, you know, it says can't be any larger than your house or a portion of your house, but there's also that portion that says 850 square feet. I haven't quite figured that out because that's what it says. And then in parentheses it says 900 square feet. So I'm not sure where that's at. I think we should go back and look into that ordinance and look and address
it. Well, wasn't that what he presented to us was just a possibility from someplace else. So we really, I agree with Mark. We need to look at that thing.
I'm just going to keep on opposing it because I think you're encroaching upon the property owner's rights too. He built it within all the current codes that we have. And like I said, it depends on all the toys he depends put on it. You know, it's his personal property he's doing with it, as long as he's not using it for commercial use. I have a problem setting more regulations than what we actually need to do.
In relation to that, I was watching the TV tonight. They're talking about putting 655 square foot signs on the Seattle towers up there, and people are saying, hey, you know, I mean, the skyline belongs to all of us, not just the people that own the building. So, I mean, this is kind of the same thing. The guy next door has a few rights too. You know, he builds that thing out there and it took his view away to the northwest. And every time he looks out his window, he's going to see it. So, you know, I think there's some place we need to take a look at that. That's all.
Okay,
I said my say.
Looks like we have four. I see. Gina, you're nodding your head in agreement. Okay, you want to do that in the September workshop again? Discuss it? We have passed it, so okay. It'll be law till then. Correct? We did pass that, right? Yeah. Didn't we pass that? Yes. So, does that sound good to everybody? Come back, we'll get it in September again.
I'd like to see a few restrictions.
Okay. Raise your hand if you're in favor of revisiting this. Three? Four. Okay. All right.
We'll put it on the workshop for September. How's that? Does that work good for everybody? And we rediscuss it again. So, since we have a majority of the council wanting to rediscuss it, we'll do that. Any other unfinished business? Okay, new business. Mark?
Again, I want to encourage everybody to look at warrants. I mean, it's not required by the audit committee, but it was pretty enlightening this month. I used to feel sorry for our Gray and Osborne guys having to come and drive clear here, but we paid them $548,000 this month, so I don't feel so sorry for them anymore. But seriously, we said we would evaluate this. Planet Consulting, we paid $3,200 to, and the Permit Center, which is both Daryl Piercy, we paid $6,000 to. So that's over $9,000 a month, and if that continues, we might as well hire somebody, because that's over $100,000 a year. And I have to have them explain how that billing works, because supposedly somebody pays a permit, and the Permit Center just gets a piece of it, and the city's supposed to get a piece. And I didn't understand the billing on that. So rightly, it needs to be explained to me, but it just kind of jumps out that that's $9,000 for that service, and I think we could hire somebody for that.
We can have Daryl talk to them.
Yeah.
I believe the school district, didn't they make a large payment to get permits?
Last month we paid Mr. Piercy on the inspection side about $34,000. And this month it was another I can't remember the number, 6,000 or something. Mm. And that is part of that school project. And of course that elevates everything because of the percentages. Under normal circumstances, those numbers just wouldn't look like that at all.
Do you know, does he have a staff or does he do that individually?
I don't know his business. He is doing that himself personally. Yes.
That's a good business. Item number two under new business is when they remodeled McFarland on the south side, they took out our walking path. And Mr. Van Ness, former employee, said yes, but they would put it back when they're done. And Debbie, if you could pass that on to Eamon, that I'd like to give council a status report on that. Because with all this paving equipment coming in, I want my walking path back, and it appears the school remodel is about done. But I think they owe us a walking path.
Mark, I had the same problem when I noticed when they were starting to do that, because they actually removed our walking path.
Right.
And I questioned, because that was city's. That was the city's walking path there. And my explanation was that during the plan review, the previous company that we had basically gave that away because they approved the plan, site plans with that. And I met Jay up there and he assured me that we would get our walking path. But then later I found out when the school put sidewalks in on that south side, that's what they are calling their walking path. But I think they need to, when they hit 10th Street, they misalign really bad. And I do think they need to at least make a cutout on the west side sidewalk and ramp there, so we have an ADA accessible ramp again that lines up with their sidewalk where it meets together, and a crosswalk put in there. Right now the crosswalk that they have from the walking path actually lines up within the center of their driveway.
Right. Where's their sidewalk? On the north side of the bus loop there? Yeah, see, that's not a walking path. You have to walk across the bus path to go to the sidewalk, and you have to walk past the bus path again to get back to the walking path. No, I would be disappointed if we lost that, because I would go back. I remember what he said, Mr. Van Ness, and it shocked me. He said, I was surprised they took that out, and then there were assurances that it would be put back. And if we lost that, that would be very disappointing to me.
That's
Because I see people now, they walk right down the middle of that bus path, which is potentially dangerous because you can have sports buses or whatever going around any hour of the day around there.
Yeah, there was also another comment, you remember, they were driving it as a road. So they're supposed to replace the rest of it.
That was my thought too, because that was what they said, that they were using that for temporary construction route there and use, and when they got through with it, they would put it back like it was. I mean, that was the impression that they gave us at that time. I didn't think it was going to go away.
I'll have Eamon check into it then and see what's going on, and we'll report back to you next meeting. Or maybe get a note in your files once he knows what the answer is. So.
I have one more, my last comment for new business. We're still tweaking this computers and stuff, and what I recall in the past is when we got to an item, the presenters would put something up and we'd all look at it. Well, it seems like the presenters think we're looking at it now, but I feel like our audience is kind of lost. So I don't know if somehow we can show what we're looking at up on the screen or what we're given or something, but just ponder that. I think that needs to be tweaked a little bit, because I think I feel like I'm looking at it, but the audience is lost because they don't have anything they're holding or looking at. The screens are blank. So you might see how we can put that all together.
Good idea. Okay.
Now I'm done with new business. Thank you.
Anybody else? New business? Ken?
I'm not prepared to get into this thing tonight, but I went up to Freda the other day for a Grant County hearing on a graffiti ordinance that the Grant County put together, and it's kind of an amendment of what they have. And what I thought I'd do, I would like to have a copy of that and let you look at it. I'll bring it back to our workshop, let you look at it, see what we can do to maybe help us as far as the fellow's concerned. It has a lot to do with graffiti, also with the property owners not taking care of it after something's been done, and some penalties that they have added, not only for the people who's doing it, and they're pretty severe penalties, but also for the property owners to clean it up so it don't continue to get worse and worse all the time. I realize us in Othello, we have somewhat of a problem when it comes to pushing, or whatever you want to say, as far as a penalty is concerned. Whether we have them do more community service or have them in jail for 30 days or whatever. But I know at least Grant County has stepped forward into that issue, and I think we ought to look at it a little bit deeper, whether it's us as a city or whether it's Adams County or what. If we could maybe work together with Adams County and get some bite into some of our rules and laws, I think that would help everybody, for the police department and everybody, to get something done on this graffiti, because as we know, that's a progressive thing that works its way on up to other crime and whatnot, and I think we need to look at it. So if you want me to, I'll dig into it a little bit. I won't have it ready for the next meeting, because I'm going to be gone, but I can get something for the workshop next, the first of the month.
Yeah, just let Debbie know about it, and she'll get it on the agenda. So, yeah.
So. Need some help from Jim, too, buddy.
Oh, okay. Any other new business?
There's we could be expecting an increase for jail fees and prosecuting coming up here, since it's coming up to budget time. Just to pre-warn you, we haven't had an increase since 2003. They were charging us $50 a day. Their costs now are $63.33, I believe it is, and they're wanting to charge $63. And then also on the prosecuting side, we're paying $50,000 now. We're probably looking at 75,000 at least.
The chief will be bringing a full report too at our next council meeting. So on this, Mark and I were at it, the chief was at it, and we met with the county. So.
Yeah, I just have a problem with the prosecutor. We entered into a contract, which we actually don't have to. The county is, if I'm right, is obligated for the prosecution to be.
You can thank Hill Hochster years ago, because Ellensburg and Kintas County got into it, that he, one of the very few bills that I know Harold ever got through the legislature, provides that when the county gives notice of an impact of a city that doesn't operate a criminal court on the district court, we are mandated to negotiate with them, and if we can't reach an agreement, it will go to binding arbitration. So they can compel the city to pay, and that's what precipitated the first negotiations years ago that led to the $50,000 you provide them now. But yeah, they can compel it.
And also, our caseload has more than doubled since this agreement started, and they have not raised any of the services, so that's something we're looking at. Any other new business? Okay, Mayor's announcements. Next Monday is the Planning Commission's meeting, so we don't have one. And then Wednesday at 12 at the Senior Citizen Center is the mayoral luncheon, if you'd like to be there. Harold, his name right, from the hospital.
Harry Giller.
Harry Giller, yes. He'll be speaking to the council, or not to the council, but to the people that show up there. So if you're interested, you're more than welcome to come. And then this meeting's adjourned. Thank you.